This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Hi, I'm Henry DeVries of UC San Diego, and this is Author Talk. Today we have Manly Feinberg, a mountain climber, author of the book Reaching Your Next Summit. And Manly's going to tell us about a life or death situation that he was in. First, let me introduce you to Manly. So Manly was a retailer with the Build a Bear workshop, and from there became an international speaker, author, and mountain climber who's done over 1,000 climbs in 9 different countries, including the Himalayas. But this was about a very special climb that happened in Yosemite National Park. The year was 2022, and there was a life or death situation on that mountain, and Manly had to make some decisions, and he'll tell us about that today. So it's the fourth night of a historic climb you're making. You are on what's called a portaledge. You are 1,000 feet up in the air, and you're going to spend the night on the edge of the cliff on this, and then something happened. So Manly, take us to that portaledge and that fateful night on El Capitan in Yosemite.
Yeah, so the portaledge is the southeast face in particular of El Capitan, and most of El Capitan is so steep there are no ledges to sleep on, no natural ledges, so we have to bring our own what we call the portaledge. It also serves as a porta potty as needed. So I'm sure you have questions about that, so I'll just explain that right now.
Okay, let's get that out of the way. Yeah.
So we can pay attention. Number one's easy. Number two is a little more difficult and dirty. It's just not fun. Every job has something about it that is very difficult or something you don't feel like doing. And so here's how it works. We go in a plastic bag that has a little chemical in it. It's like a porta potty chemical that's supposed to make it not smell. It doesn't work. Surprise. Into another bag, and then we put that bag into basically a dry bag of sorts, a rubber dry bag you would canoe with or whatever, and then we drag that up the wall, and then we drag it all the way down the wall, and then we dispose of it properly in a dumpster, and you think you have baggage, Henry.
There you go.
So we're on the portaledge. As you said, fourth night of the climb, or over 1,000 feet up on the wall. My son and I, you may see in the video in the opening, there was a little purple portaledge, a two-person version, 4x6-foot ledge, and then there's a red single-person ledge that our friend Steve Schneider was sleeping on next to us. So we get up to this spot after the end of the fourth day, and by 10 p.m. Steve is already, Steve's been doing this for over 40 years, he's a professional and one of the greatest ever. So he has his stuff all set up and has his dinner cooked, has his hot beer, he's out crashed by 10 p.m., no problem. Midnight, my son and I are still trying to figure out where's the food and where's the can opener? Of course, the can opener is always in one of these. We have 8 bags over 500 pounds of equipment. It's always in the bag that's the furthest away. So we finally get our gear together. We're finally ready to cook dinner at about midnight. And I was oriented this way on the mountain, and Steve was behind me. And I hear this grunting and grumbling from behind me. And all of a sudden, Steve sits up about a foot on his portaledge, and he says, "It hurts!" And he clutches his chest, and he collapses back onto his portaledge. So I look at my son, I said, "Steve's in trouble, huh?" My son's, by the way, his name is Manly version 3.0, our best version yet. And Manly said, "Yeah, Steve's in trouble, Dad." So another question people always have, how do you not roll out of bed? We're always tied in. So the first thing I did is make sure I'm tied in. I happen to be able to get to Steve faster because I was oriented in that direction. So I get to Steve, I start straddling him on top of his portaledge because he's actually half convulsing on the portaledge. And it's not very big, because I don't want him to bounce off. His skin is hanging off his body. He's ice cold. His eyes are rolling back in his head. And he's mumbling. And he's clutching his chest. And I'm absolutely freaking out. So I said, "Manly, we got to call for a rescue."
Oh, boy. Okay, I have to ask a question right now. This sounds insane. Climbing mountains sounds insane. Sleeping on the side of a mountain sounds insane. Dragging Manly 3 up the mountain sounds insane. So why do you do this?
Why I do it is a little harder to explain. It's hard. And it's like, I'm sure everyone that watches this has done something in life that's difficult, whether it's having a kid or starting a business or going to college or school or anything you face, right? So it's in that realm. But one thing that's inherent in your question is it looks dangerous, it looks stupid, right? And I want to eliminate that question right now or explain that. It's actually, believe it or not, it's 10 times safer than driving a car. And that statistic was before text messaging. And I know most people don't believe me. They're like, come on, really? I mean, the consequences are high, but it's actually safer than driving a car. Some things we do, like riding a bicycle on a road, road cycling is actually very hazardous, much more hazardous than climbing rocks. If you don't believe me, you can ask my Northwestern Mutual Life Insurance underwriters. So it is safer, but you do have to know what you're doing, obviously. And it is very, very difficult physically. And this kind of climbing in particular, I call it the blue collar of climbing, because it's not glamorous. It's very slow. It's really a grind. But you become somebody better than you were before by subjecting yourself to such suffering.
So let's set the scene. You've climbed everywhere. You've told me that your favorite place in the world to climb is Yosemite.
It is.
Why is that?
It's not just my favorite place to climb, and thank you for asking. It's actually my favorite place in the world, period. I've been to over 500 destinations, outdoor destinations, and a lot of times I'll tell people, you've got to make this a bucket list item. Go to Yosemite. You've got to go to Yosemite. And sometimes people say, well, you're a climber, that's why. So you tell me, Henry, where is your favorite place in the world?
Yosemite National Park.
Thank you. So, and do you climb?
I climb into my car.
Exactly. So anybody, if you're watching this and you haven't seen, been to Yosemite, you have to experience it. And it's so beautiful. You just have to be there and present in it. And it's a gift from the universe or whatever you believe in. It's there for us to enjoy. And you have to go be present in Yosemite. And Yosemite also has El Capitan, which is considered the greatest rock wall on planet Earth. This massive wall over 3,400 feet tall.
Give us some perspective on how high that is, like the St. Louis Arch. How many of those would it be?
Great question. So the St. Louis Arch is 630 feet tall, which is about the same height of an average skyscraper in an American city. So if you've seen El Cap, you get it. If you haven't, maybe you've seen the St. Louis Arch, or maybe you've seen a skyscraper. Six St. Louis arches are six skyscrapers it takes to reach past the summit of El Capitan, and they look like little pencils when I put it in scale in the image.
Now, this was a historic climb with Steve Schneider, who you call a Michael Jordan of the sport. So tell us about Steve.
Yeah, Steve, the story really starts in July of 2022. My family and I were camping in on the east side of the Sierras in Yosemite. And we ran into Steve and his wife, and we got to be really connected and just really intermingled with his family and mine. Started having meals together and connecting. And Steve is a legend, literally, and especially in Yosemite, one of the greatest ever. And he's got extraordinary accomplishments all over the globe. Climbing El Capitan a single time is a lifetime achievement for a climber. At the time we met Steve, he had climbed El Capitan 129 times. So one night we're sitting around the campfire, and Steve says, he leans in, and he's got this classic Southern California surfer voice guy, and he's just a really, really entertaining character. And he says, y'all are seeing me limping around my hip. They want to replace my hip. My thumb hardly works anymore. I've had dealing with diabetes for 22 years. And he said, but I've got one more dream before I hang it up. And we all leaned in and said, what's the dream, Steve? And he says, I want to be the second person in the history of the world to climb El Capitan more than 100 ascents via 50 different routes. My son leans in, mainly three, and says, Steve, I'm just still dreaming of my first El Cap climb. So later on that night, Steve pulls me aside and he said, what are you doing in October? I said, I've got 2 weeks open. What do you have in mind? He said, I want you to be my partner on the climb. And I was a little stunned at first. He said, you in? I said, I'm in. We get to talk and he said, Manly, he said, with my hip and my, I'm 63 right now and I'm coming to the end of my career, I'm not going to be able to lead many pitches. So the leading part, let me explain that real quick. Somebody's got to tie in the end of the rope and step up into the unknown. And that feels like that to maybe anyone who's watching this, that we're called in our lives at times. We don't know what's next necessarily all the time. And somebody's got to step up and take the rope up into life or the wall. And so the leading's difficult. And a pitch is a section of climbing, basically, usually 150 to 200 feet or so in length. We either stop and we run out of rope, or we get to a good spot to stop. Sometimes there's a natural ledge. Now, in this case, this route is so steep, there are hardly any ledges. But so usually about every 200 feet or so, there'll be a pause. But Steve said, look, you're going to have to lead most of the pitches on the route. And the route he had picked is a very difficult route. And I was getting a little nervous, and he could see it. He said, Manly, he said, don't worry, I can call a third. We can put a third on the team. And it's true. Most anyone in the world out there, all the pros and people with Steve's status and his legendary in his attitude, almost anyone would answer the call. I said, I've got a really crazy idea, Steve. I said, what about Manly 3? And he, without hesitation, he said, I'm in. He said, I love that kid. He's so solid. And I just, it would be an honor. Father-son team and me. He said, I got it. He said, question though, if his Manly 3's coming on the team to take some burden off the leading and going to take the rope up for us, and you know this is a hard route. He said, how many pitches of hard big wall climbing, where a big wall is where you live on the wall for days to get to the top. He said, how many pitches of big wall climbing has Manly 3 led? I said, none yet. But Steve had a really beautiful moment right here. Steve's never had any leadership training in his life, but he was a natural born leader and encourager of others. He said, he's your new leader and he's just future for you. You know that. And for us. And he said, I believe in him. You believe in him. Let's start pouring into him. You get him out, do some training, get him ready for October. I said, I got it. I'm in. So I go back to the family that night. It was the funniest moment this day. And I tell the family, I said, you'll never believe it. Steve wants me to be his partner on his historic ascent. And everybody said, oh, wow. And I said, you'll never believe he wants to be the third. And I'm sure they thought he might say Alex Honnold or Tommy Caldwell, one of these famous people, many of which Steve had mentored, by the way. And I said, Manly, he wants you to be the third. So my son gets a little uncomfortable. He said, I'm in, Dad. It's been my dream since I've been 8 years old. He said, well, I'll do anything. I'll carry extra gear, food, cook, anything I need to do. He said, one thing. He said, I don't want to lead any pitches. So what do you do when someone, you see something in someone they don't see themselves, right? And I just said, don't worry about that for now. But so Steve and I start pouring into him, of course, and building up his belief, getting him out and doing some training. And then before you know it, October had arrived.
Now, in your book, you talk about declaring your next climb. So how does that relate to this, your current climb?
Yeah, your current climb. So yeah, so it's this actually relates to, I think, everybody in a way. And this is going to sound crazy, but you know, you tell me in your life, Henry, are you trying to climb one mountain, or do you feel like you're trying to climb multiple mountains?
Lord, you've given me many mountains to climb. Yeah. I've published 200 books.
There you go, 200 mountains, right? And you don't publish one at a time, right?
Nope.
So, and personal life, right? We all have multiple mountains. And there's something about climbing that actually I believe is easier than the life we try to live in our day-to-day lives, and that is we can't just focus on one mountain. But this was really the first lesson that I talk about in the book that really I started applying in my day-to-day life, especially at Build-A-Bear. Build-A-Bear was crazy. We went from 42 stores to 454 stores in a very short amount of time. And I would go climbing and realize I had to turn my cell phone off or not have service at all. And I got to focus in such a way and build momentum behind a single initiative that it was really powerful. So how this translates to day-to-day life is I want people to think of it as a declaration of momentum. To always have one initiative in your life and one climb to say, it's not to say, I know people, oh, wait, you focus on one project. I can't do that. I know. I'm just asking you to focus on one initiative first, always. And thinking of it as a declaration of momentum to put your foot down and say, this is the one thing. I know if I move this forward every single day, once I build momentum in this area, then it's going to bleed into other areas. And so in this case, Steve had picked the climb because he knew the route he needed to do to get to 50 different routes. So the current climb had been declared. But my intention and encouragement to the audience is to, what is that for you? And always have that initiative. Keep it in your face. I say visibility drives velocity. So we have to keep the current climb in our face because everything's vying for our attention and to make money off us, which is really difficult. So old school tools, post-it notes, calendar events. What is your current climb? And move it forward a little bit every day, 5, 10, 20 minutes. The most tactical chapter in the book is it's something I still struggle with all the time, just building that momentum. But once you build momentum in one climb, it'll bleed over into all the other projects in your life. So that clarity is really key.
Something I took from the book is, it sounds like this is a singular pursuit, but it really takes a team to accomplish something great. And you use a phrase from mountain climbing about being en belay. Tell us what that means, to be en belay.
Thank you for asking. This is the heart of my work. And this is really like, so if we fast forward to October, we get to the base of the wall. We've got 550 pounds of equipment. We're all loaded up. And during this time, by the way, we're pouring into Manly, Steve and I both saying, not only do we want you to lead on the wall, we want you to lead the first pitch on the wall. And so for him to be able to do that and for him to be able to step up into the unknown and in a courageous way, knowing that it's his first ever big wall lead, in our lives, we all need to know. I happen to have a piece of rope with me that I use in my keynotes and workshops. We all need to know that somebody's got the rope in their hands for us. So if I'm going to go, who's holding the rope down there, right? Because the expectation is, I'm human, I'm going to fall. So then the question becomes, instead of, well, what happens if I fall? The question shifts from, well, of course, when I fall, what happens next? right? And if you have somebody holding the rope for you, they're going to lock the rope off. So there are four keys to being a good belay. Number one, we have to be present and encourage. So present is hard these days, right? Maybe it's whether it's a business meeting or dinner table, phones down, and we're human to human. We're fully connected so that we sense and the person feels it, and we're encouraging. I got you. I'm here. I don't know how we're going to get through this, but I know we will. I believe it. Number one, it's encouragement. The second thing we need to do is make sure that we don't give out too much slack. When the climber is going up at the belayer, B-L-A-Y or B-L-A-Y-E-R, the belayer's feeding out too much slack. When the climber falls, they could fall too far and hurt themselves, right? So in business and life, this looks like putting off a difficult conversation as an example, right? They put too much slack in the system. I did this all the time in my leadership at Build-A-Bear. It's probably one of my weakest leadership characteristics is that I would put off those conversations, put slack in the system, which really serves me and not them, right? It's not being a courageous leader. The third key is also critical, the opposite actually. Sometimes as a belayer in life, we can hold the rope too tight. And so the climber can't move. We can pull them off the wall if they try to move, the rope's too tight, and micromanaging as we know it in day to day. And then fourth, most critical of all, we have to be so present and so in tune and so regularly in contact with that person in our life that we have on belay or that has us on belay, that so when we see them fall, we immediately lock the rope off, whether it's physically on the mountain or in life, and say, I see that you fell. I got you. Let's get you back on the wall and get you climbing again as quickly as possible. So real quick, as far as actionable on this thing, people are like, oh, that's great, cool. But I really try to focus on making sure people have crystal clear ideas. What do I do with this? Day to day, it just means, I want to encourage people to ask two questions. Who do I need on belay for everything I'm trying to accomplish in my life? And then secondly, who will I belay today? And then to just reach out and make a meaningful, intentional connection to that person, each of those people, every single day. This is outbound. It's not responding to all the emails and texts and endless inputs we have. But it's coming from a different source, and a heart or head or whatever you believe, to make that have that moment. Who do I need on belay for me? Who needs me today? And reach out to them. Hopefully, ideally in person, voicemail, email, text. I got you on belay, or whatever that message might be. Thinking of you. Simple messages to consistently build those relationships.
But it doesn't always go easy. Sometimes you've got to start over. In your book, you talk about master the art of the restart. What is that?
Yeah. This is the tactical counterpart to the current climb. So Manly takes off in that first section of climbing, by the way. Before he does, though, he steps up to the wall. And I have a great photo of him looking back at me, and he asked me that question. Dad, do you have me on belay? I said, I got you, son. Go. We know you can do this. So he steps up. We call it sending it. He leads the first pitch, second pitch, third pitch. The next day, we get on the wall together, and Steve actually said, hey, man, I'm gonna get back on. I've been rehabbing my hip. He said, I want to contribute up here. I want to take this lead. My son says, before it was barely out of Steve's mouth, he says, I got you, Steve. I got you on belay. Steve said, good. Here we go. So Steve leads out about 120 feet to the left on this overhanging pitch, about 450 feet up off the wall, off the ground. And then a piece of equipment that Steve had in the wall pops out. Bing! Whew. He goes about 25 feet, 30 feet. Spins around and pops his bad hip on the wall. And then he lets what I like to call some Kentucky English fly. And fair enough, right? So, and he's screaming at himself, and he's mad, he's griping about it. And then he says something about it. Why did you bring that piece of equipment? I hate those pieces of gear. And I'm like, and then finally he like just catches himself. Once he got out of the system, he looks back at Manly 3. He said, Manly 3, you saved me. Thanks for having me on belay. And Manly said, I got you, Steve, go. And when he said go, it was like lightning hit Steve. And he springs into life. He immediately Batman's back up the road. There's a way we ascend back up to his high point on the wall. And he gets moving again. And so I call this master of the art of the restart. So because people, this is something I just thought everybody assumed that they know we fall. We're human, right? That's how I get a lot of work in the world of safety, by the way. We're humans. So we expect to fall. So it's not like we're not trying to be perfect. We're trying to have no incidents. But we know, like, okay, when we fall, what happens? So we restart. So the way this relates to day-to-day life is that, first of all, there's a mindset to say, of course I fell. Like, all these things, you go to a great conference, you watch something, you're inspired or whatever it is, like, and you start a new initiative, and of course you're going to fall off your current climb or whatever it is. And then we go, well, I'll restart. Maybe I'll restart. First of all, it's the expectation. Of course I fell. Here I am at the end of my rope again. If this was easy, everybody would do it. And then, so that's first a mindset, but then to say, okay, I'm going to restart, and I'm not going to wait till Monday. I'm not going to wait to the first of the year. That's a good one. The calendar restart, I call that. I'll restart the first of the month or the first of the year. And then there's the emotional restart. When I feel better, I do this one a lot to myself. I'll restart when I feel better. Let you give yourself some grace. Let the sun set and rise the next morning and restart. Get back on it. A couple quick tactical tips. Steve, in this case, didn't know how to do the move 100 feet up. And he didn't worry about that. He got back up there and he's like, what are the next two or three moves I need to do to get moving? Mm. Right. And you said something to me years ago. How can you get started in a small way? Right. Same concept. And then get on with it before you're ready. You know, 80% ready, or you got to get moving again. And that is the tactical piece of the momentum. You combine that with the current climb, and I think you'll start to feel yourself really moving forward in your initiatives in a way that's just really powerful.
Well, take us back to the ledge. It's midnight. It's hit the fan, and you're calling. You know, we got to call for an evacuation. We got to do a rescue. But Manly 3 steps up. Tell us about that.
Yeah, totally steps up. He literally stepped up, as I said. He didn't want to lead any pitches, and he's leading a lot of the pitches. And this whole time, I'm freaking out immediately. So I'm on top of Steve, and Manly's right above me, hanging above me. And I said, we got to call for a rescue. And he said, Dad, he's calm, just chilling. He just takes a deep breath. He said, Dad, take a deep breath. He said, let's call Dave and Tina. Dave and Tina are Manly's girlfriend's parents, and they are both doctors. But it's 1 in the morning. So he puts it on speakerphone, he dials Tina's phone, and less than a ring, she answers the phone. She says, what's going on, guys? I said, Tina, we're over 5,000 feet up, and Steve clutched his chest, he's flopping around. So then they immediately, it's like seeing like ER or something on TV, and it's maddening, crazy. And the place where we're hanging, by the way, if we drop anything, it's going, if there's nothing to catch it. It's nothing but air to the ground. So very high consequential situation. We are tied in, of course, but they start triaging, checking, did he hit his head today, and trying to figure out what happened, what's going on with him. Check his pulse here, shine a light in his left pupil, his right pupil, check his pulse again. And then in the middle of this, I said, we got to call for a rescue. And Tina said, how long would that take? And I said, "It 3 hours or something, Tina, but they're the best in the world. And they are the best competent vertical rescue team on the planet. And I knew that. I wanted him to come save me. And Tina said, well, hang on a second. And Dave and I think that you mentioned he has low blood sugar. If it's a heart attack or stroke, we're going to have to call for a rescue anyway. But you mentioned he has diabetes. We think it's low blood sugar. It could be high or vice versa. And we're going to take a risk. Manly 2, we want you to start feeding him sugar. Manly 3, get in his little pack that you said he had with his glucometer and his insulin syringes and everything. Get in there and find his glucometer and a thing to prick his skin. We got to get a blood test immediately. But in the meantime, we're going to have you give him. We found a goo energy pack, sugar packet, right? Energy gel. And I was trying to feed that to him, but I get about maybe half of it in his mouth. It's all over his face. And I'm out of sugar. I says, Tina, we're out of sugar. I'm out of sugar. She said, what else do you have that's sweet? I said, I've got these watermelon pucks in my pocket. But I said, he's going to choke. She said, chew him up, feeding baby bird style. Oh, okay. So I'm chewing him up. Feeding baby bird style. I know it's funny now, right? I'm feeding baby bird style and rubbing on his throat like a cat. You're trying to feed a cat a pill or something, and he's trying to get him to eat him and get a few of them down him, but it's getting worse. So Dave says, hey, we got to get blood out of him. Let's get a blood test. We're going to go sugar, but we got to get a blood test. Manly 3, hand him the thing to prick his skin. So I don't even, there's a lot of little grace moments in this story. My son happened to be part of a study at CU Boulder 6 months prior, where he used the exact same model of device to prick his skin every day, 4 times a day.
Yep.
And he used the exact same model of glucometer to check his blood. Because I'm just flipping out. So there's no way they're going to teach me how to use a glucometer on the fly. Yeah. So he's operating it. He's running the show. He hands me the thing to prick his skin. The problem is his hands are covered in calluses, right? Lifetime climber, part-time electrician here and there to make money. There's no getting through that skin. So I go to his legs, all over his legs. All over both arms, both earlobes, and not a speck of blood. And Dave says that we're in trouble. His organs are pulling the blood in, and we got to get blood. I said, Manly 3, hand your dad a syringe, one of his syringes with a needle on it. And I said, what? He said, you're going to stab him. So okay. And so I start stabbing all over his legs, all over his arms, both earlobes, and still not a speck of blood. And Dave says, we've got minutes. We're really in trouble. And then about that moment, Steve goes completely limp in my arms, and I completely flip. I said, we got to call for a rescue. We got to call for a rescue. And Dave says, Manly 2, I need you to take a deep breath. He said, I need to hear another one. He said, you need to hear what we're going to say next. And Tina says, Manly, he's dying right now. In the next few minutes, he's going to die in your arms. Or you're going to save his life. We believe it's low blood sugar. We believe you have everything you need to save his life right now. And we do not have time for a rescue. Are we clear? In that moment, something swept over me that I call exponential commitment. And then the next thing Dave said really blew my mind. He said, grab your knife. I said, what? I'm getting my head wrapped around saving his life. And then he says, you're going to stab him with your knife. We have to have a blood out of him right now to get a blood test. And I remember in that specific moment, I never said it out loud, but as clear as day in my head, I said, I am not stabbing the legendary Steve Schneider on his historic ascent of El Capitan. I'm going to get blood out of his ear right now. And so I said, Steve, this is going to hurt. He was gone. He didn't feel it, didn't hear it. But I went back to his left earlobe, and I've never squeezed something so hard in my life. I squeezed it and squeezed it and squeezed it and got a little speck of blood. Manly three hands me the glucometer, ding, read air. Ah! I hand it back to him. He has to reload it 7 times before we got a good reading. It was at 39, by the way. So we had been able to move it up some. Those of you who know about blood sugar, it was out of, we think it was in the low 20s, or doctors do that we've had this conversation with. We finally get into the low 39, and then I was still freaking out. I'm like, well, what do I do? And then Dave and Tina said, look, okay, let's get it to 80. And then once he's around 80, or even sooner, he's going to be able to manage it himself and check him 2 more times. And they said, get ready to go down. You're probably going to need to rescue tomorrow. Self-rescue, or actually call for that rescue in the morning, because he's going to be done. He's going to be really wiped out.
Whoa. Whoa. I'm supposed to ask you, how far were you willing to go to save his life?
Yeah.
So far. Well,
there's another little detail there that I almost skipped, is that how did you get it from 39 on up? We happen to have, it's another little grace moment, or whatever your belief system is, I don't know or care, but we've never ever carried Pedialyte on a climb before. But we had a bottle of Pedialyte that Manly, we were in Vaughn's in Fresno, and he said, Dad, remember our cousin talking about this can really help you if you're bonking? And he said, should we get a few of them? I said, sure. Throw them in there. So drop by drop, sip by sip, we nurse Steve's blood sugar back.
I have to tell the audience, yeah. Goo and Pedialyte did not sponsor this episode. So you're feeding him like a baby bird. You're putting Pedialyte in him.
Exactly. And finally get his blood sugar back up. The next morning he wakes up and he says, what in the beep? What happened last night? I feel like I got run over by a truck. I said, brother, blood sugar was low. I jumped over there on you. I said, man, you butt naked from the waist down. You had a T-shirt on. I said, I hopped on and got to work. And I saw a baby bird feeding you. He said, you were baby bird feeding me? What? So I said, yeah. I said, you were in trouble. I said, Dave and Tina saved you, man. We called Dave and Tina. He had met them that summer. And I said, they saved your life. He said, you all saved my life. We got a little argument. I said, no. I said, you would have died if it was up to me, my friend. Manly and Dave and Tina saved your life. He said, well, you all saved my life. I said, fine. And then he says, we said, hey, Dave, look, Steve, we know this is an important climb for you. But we'll come back when you feel better. I said, you know, Manly and I, we have a plan. We're going to self-rescue. We're going to get us down. He said, go down. Go down. What? He said, we're not effing going down. You can imagine, right? He said, we're going to the summit. He said, I'm going to rest. You all fix what we call fixing a pitch. So take the rope up higher. Let's get some climbing done. You all take the rope higher. Come back down. We'll spend the night. He said, tomorrow I'm back on. We're going to the summit. That's what I call exponential team commitment.
Exponential team commitment. So explain exponential commitment.
Thank you. So if you had paused the story right before Dave says, Manly, two, I need you to take a deep breath. And if you had asked me, are you committed, are you 100% in committed to saving this man's life? I would have said, absolutely. I probably would have been offended. I'd be like, yeah, of course I am. But I wasn't. I think I was 99% committed. Because there was 1% of me that didn't want him to die in my arms. I knew there was an incompetent team that could rescue him potentially, which I found out later there was not enough time for that. It would take an 8 or 10 hours. I wanted them to bail me out. I didn't believe I could do it on top of that. But what I realized in that moment is that the difference between 99% commitment and 100% commitment is not 1%. It's exponential. The impact And you know it when you know it when you feel it. I know everyone who's watching this or sitting here, you know that in life, those moments you're like, I am all in. I am absolutely 100% committed to this. That's it. I'm in. Yeah. That's it. That's what I call exponential commitment.
So, and I'm sorry I called mountain climbing insane. No, going up that mountain, right now I call that insane. Yeah, this is insane that you're going to keep
right
going up. So take us up the mountain. How did you get day five? And so, now yeah, we're
that's
gonna
day
keep
five.
Going.
So, and this is beautiful, and there's some segments that, you know, I can show visually. And this, when you feel the team, and I know people have felt that hopefully in their life at some point when the whole team, whether your family, your relationships, at work, whatever that is, and you're all committed. It's an incredible feeling. And we felt, even though we were exhausted, of course, that so Manley and I pushed the rope higher that day, got the established a higher point on the wall. Then day six, we moved the camp up. Day seven, we're just grinding. Steve gets back on lead on day six, by the way, rotating through. We're all leading up the wall. Day seven comes and goes. Day eight comes and goes. And day eight, we're getting very close to the top of the wall, but we were also very close to running out of food and water. And the sun had set, and I was determined to take the rope up. We knew there was a small ledge, about a 5-foot by 5-foot ledge, about 150 feet from the top, that was flat and would give us a chance to stand and sort things out and rest better. If not, go ahead and summit. So I take off in the dark, which we do occasionally with headlamps. It's relatively safe. I did get to a point about 75 feet up, though, where I wasn't sure if I could get the what we call protection, the gear in. I couldn't see what was around the corner, but I could see down to my left there was a little ledge sticking out, a little bulge. And I thought, that's just enough. If I do fall, that could clip my ankle or something. I thought, everything we've been through, I'm not going to risk it at this point. So I made a safety call. I said, we're going to spend another night on the wall. And Steve, this was incredible, even though he's been doing it a long time. A lot of times, people who've been doing something a long time can get complacent with safety. But Steve was very safe. And he said, definitely, let's spend another night on the wall. We'll summit tomorrow. So day nine comes. Finally, we get to this little ledge. And it was just a beautiful moment. There's sun filtering through the trees. And what's really wild about this moment is that it was Steve's turn to lead. And if I want to rewind for a second. At the base of the wall, when Steve said, I think I'm going to be able to lead a few pitches, I said, well, listen, Steve, I don't care who leads anything, but I would love Manley for him to have the summit pitch. And it happened to be the only easy section on the wall. Because I said, I remember what it felt like on my, I got to have the summit pitch when I was first climbed El Cap in 97. And he said, let's just see how it works out. Which means I knew he wanted it. So it was his turn. I said, Steve, it's your turn. Take the lead. And my son said, can I belay you, Steve? And he said, no. He said, what? He said, I'm not taking the summit pitch. He said, Manley 3, you're taking us to the summit.
Was that wise to have Manley 3 take the summit pitch?
Absolutely. As far as his competency, it was the easiest section. And Steve had already put him on some sections that were incredibly difficult. But Manley resisted just out of graciousness. And says, he said, no, Steve, this is your climb. We both argued with him. He said, no, you're taking the summit pitch. It's your turn. And he said, no. He said, you all saved my life. He said, Manley 3, you didn't want to climb. You didn't want to lead any pitches. Mm-hmm. You're about to lead pitch 8 of 17. Your dad's led 5. I've led 4. You're taking us to the summit. I've got you on belay.
There's a life lesson you teach from this, and it's about celebrating the summit. And tell us about celebrating the summit.
Yeah, thank you. So Manley takes off. He actually climbs out of sight, so we can't really see him. So Steve and I are just sitting there, just listening and waiting to hear some sign he'd made the summit. And finally we hear it, woo! And we just look at each other and grin. It's like, yeah. And I sent Steve up next with our last bit of food and water. And I had this kind of surreal moment. It was perfect weather, 70-some degrees, and just laying there. And I just imagined how wonderful it was going to be to hug Steve and embrace him and congratulate him. But I just couldn't wait to hug my son, because I wanted to feel who he had become. So I make it to the summit, and what's wild about this is I have footage, because I'd hired a video team to capture our summit. Never had this happen in all the thousands of climbs I've done. Never had a team to film the summit. So there's footage of Manley summiting, there's footage of Steve summiting, and then of Manley and I embracing. And then we celebrated the summit. So it's a good lesson, because I think in life, especially in America in this case, or most places in the world, I feel like we're always grinding, we're always trying to accomplish, we're always going from one thing to the next, failure or success, on to the next thing. And we don't celebrate the summits, little ones, big ones. And so we did, of course, we celebrated the summit. But that's not really actually the biggest lesson there. The lesson for me is the moment that Steve put Manley on the summit. So lesson 5 in this particular conversation is that put others on the summit first. Right. And that's what's really beautiful about it, too, is that, you know, Steve, like I said, never had any leadership training, but that was one of the most beautiful leadership moments I've ever seen in my life, for him to put Manly on the summit and honor him in that way. And so I always ask the audience a question. It's like, so who will you put on the summit next? Who's that? Always have someone in your target. Who's that next person that you're going to put on the summit?
Well, here we are. Story's over. You're on top of the mountain. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. And I know, not only did you have to get down, you had to be in L.A. 24 hours later. How did you get down off this mountain?
Good question. Yeah, so it was a little twist to the story, and we were kind of under a time gun. I remember I said I had 2 weeks. We thought we had plenty of time. I always think we have plenty of time for a project, right? So 3 p.m. on Thursday, we summit. But 3 p.m. on Friday, I'm to be in Pasadena Auditorium in front of 1,000 people with the keynote. And those of you know California, on Friday afternoon, getting from Yosemite to L.A., hitch-free is tricky. Normally, so getting down off El Cap, let's talk about that for a second. So it's actually, for the magnitude of that mountain, it's one of the easiest mountains of that size to get off anywhere in the world, actually. So typically 3, 4, 5 hours of hiking and about 400 feet of rappelling. It's not a fun hike. It's not one you would go do, and I would not recommend this hike in Yosemite. It's a loose gully. It's very steep and not fun. But with Steve's hip and our condition, it took us over 6 hours to get down. So it's midnight. We sort our gear out. It's 2 a.m. And my son says, Dad, you're the one that always says driving is the most dangerous part. He said, I'm wasted. I'm done. I can't drive safely. I said, I got us. I said, I'll go. I'm going to find us a hotel. We'll hit Wawona. We'll hit, you know, then Oakdale. We're going to, first hotel we hit, I'll get us a room and we'll get a couple hours of sleep. He said, that's all I need. 2 hours, 3 hours. We'll get a shower, which we definitely needed. And he said, what time do you need to be on the curb? I said, 1:30. I said, stage time's 3. He said, I got you. Let's go. So we make it to a hotel, 2 hours of sleep in Oakhurst, and 1:30 p.m. I step on the curb. 3 p.m. I'm on stage, and I'm in California. It's less than 24 hours later, and I had to say something. I actually grabbed a couple little bit of footage, edited the slides on the way in the car while he's driving me, and I told the audience briefly, you know, what had happened, a very, very short version. And then when I talk about the belay, a lot of times I'll acknowledge someone in the room, and so I brought him up on stage, and there wasn't a dry eye in the whole place. And there's a photo I usually show right here that an audience member took. And I'll just share with you what I shared with that audience. I said that, you know, I really struggled in the pandemic with anxiety, depression. My business was wrecked. It was like a perfect storm in life. And my whole family, my wife, my daughter, and especially my son really picked me up again and again and again. And I wouldn't have made it through that without him and my family. I certainly wouldn't have made it to the summit of El Cap. Steve would have died in my arms if it wasn't for Manly, too, no question. And I wouldn't have made it to that stage. I don't think I'd be sitting here with you if it wasn't for his exponential commitment to me and my exponential commitment to him.
Last question, Manly. Most of us are not going to climb literal mountains. What's your main message, your main takeaway for all of us?
I hope that the story and the message, I feel like the message was gifted to me. It came to me, through me. But I think it's a fundamental truth, undeniable, that I think everyone that sees this, I hope, will be honest with themselves and reflect and ask themselves a question, what do I need to exponentially commit to? And I think for a lot of people, that's something that maybe you were committed to. Maybe it's a marriage, a relationship, a child, or a job, or a calling, or something in your life that maybe you were committed to, or it's something new. But you know in your heart, you might be playing along. That's the thing. I think as humans, we can fool ourselves. We can do, well, I'm working hard. I'm stressed. I'm showing up. But you know deep in your heart, when you're fully 100% exponentially committed and when you're not. And I just ask people to be honest and dig deep and ask yourself, what do you need to exponentially commit to? It's worth it.
Thank you, Manly Feinberg. If you want more information on Manly, go to his website, verticallessons.com. Until next time, this is Henry DeVries for Author Talk.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.